state, he's incredibly popular. And so Pat Quinn, the governor there, who's really vulnerable, was very happy to have the president not just come campaign for him, but also raise him $1.5 million at a fundraiser in Chicago. That helps. And so in some of these states like Michigan, the Democratic candidate for governor very much wants Obama to come, especially because he can motivate and activate the drop-off voters. So a state like Michigan has a lot of African-Americans, a lot of young people, the Obama coalition. Right now, when you look at the polls, they're not seen as likely voters. And the hope is that Obama actually could motivate them, even if overall his approval rating is much lower than it was when he carried the state 2 years ago.
We're going to take our first caller for this segment now, and that will be Rich from Easton, Pennsylvania, on the Democratic line.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Holman, do you think that if they got all the Republican senators and congressmen to just vote no and take a pledge to just vote no against Ebola, that nothing would happen in this United States? Thank you.
Well, Rich, it's on the Ebola question, obviously, legislative remedies are difficult. You're seeing a lot of members kind of send letters, call for different things. You saw a lot of Republicans call yesterday for basically banning flights into the United States from Africa. The guest in the last hour talked about the public health dimensions. There's really no, it's not clear what Congress could pass. One, they're out of session until after the elections. They're back home campaigning. But two, it's not clear what the legislative remedy would be, what you would be voting against or for.
Next up is David from Carnegie, Pennsylvania, on the Republican line.
Hi, I was calling in only because I usually, I would say 70% of the time vote Republican, but this time I happen to not be very comfortable voting for Corbett, because even though they say that Pennsylvania is on the rise, and it is because of the gas underneath us, but I see the jobs are going to people from out of state because we don't have enough qualified people in this state to take those jobs. So I'm going to vote for Wolf. Plus, I watched our gas tax go up 28 cents, and yet we're not charging anything to bring the gas out of underneath us. And from what I understand, Pennsylvania is almost like the Saudi Arabia of the gas. So I know West Virginia and Ohio charge, you know, to bring it out of the ground. So I just don't understand why Corbett doesn't make up some of the money that we're losing that way.
Yeah, David just captured exactly the reason Tom Corbett is going to lose by 20 points.
You ranked Pennsylvania as the most vulnerable governor on your list. Yeah.
And 3 years ago, I actually wrote a story that called Tom Corbett a dead man walking, which is pretty early. It's been one of those things where this guy's like Rodney Dangerfield. He can't catch a break. He gets no respect. You know, he did raise taxes in some ways. You know, arguably, he had to make a lot of tough decisions because there were budget problems when he took over. But he's been hammered over his handling of the Penn State Jerry Sandusky investigation when he was Pennsylvania's attorney general. He was ultimately cleared of wrongdoing. But for 2 years, there was this cloud that kind of hung over him. And to David's point, you know, he said, I mostly vote Republican. And when you look at the polls in Pennsylvania, about a third of Republicans, and some of them, are defecting from Tom Corbett. So Pennsylvania is a Democratic-leaning state. I think it's kind of it's a bluish-purple state. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, a lot of Republicans aren't even voting for Corbett. And they've attacked Wolf. They've thrown everything they have at him. But it really hasn't changed the underlying dynamic. And at this point, a lot of the big outside groups that might spend money there have just kind of all agreed that it's off the table, off the map, and have moved on.
Next up is Brian from Massillona, Michigan, on the Democratic line, Michigan being another state that's on James Homan's vulnerable list to watch.
Good morning. I'm talking about Mr. Rick Snyder, the flip-flopper. Mr. Rick Snyder, first he gave money to schools all 4 years of his gubernatorial office, and he's lying like a horse thief. Took out $1.7 billion out of education. Give it back about $1 billion so far. That's his idea of paying education ahead 4 years. He flipped off on the right to work law. He wasn't for that until it passed through the legislature. Then he signed it. So he's a liar.
Well, that's I think you capture one of the reasons the Democrats are actually feeling very good about Michigan. So there were all these ads about education spending, and the Democratic Governors Association, largely with the support of organized labor, because they hate Rick Snyder, you know, especially because he signed right-to-work legislation at the end of 2012. He initially had kind of said he didn't necessarily want to, didn't really have a position, wasn't a priority of his. Then it passed a very conservative state legislature, and he signed it because he didn't feel like he had a choice, and that really upset the unions. And so probably even higher than beating Scott Walker in Wisconsin, you know, who's kind of the known as the public enemy number one of unions, Snyder is also a top target. Anyway, so with all that money early on, the Democratic Governors Association ran these really brutal attack ads highlighting education cuts in the first year that Snyder was governor. And he didn't forcefully respond. There was a degree of overconfidence on the part of the governor. He felt like he's actually achieved big things, and he's pretty popular with the D.C. set. And because he didn't respond, his negatives started to rise, and his approval rating really took a hit. And so they were running these ads saying there's this Michigan comeback. People weren't feeling it, and the Democratic ads were getting traction. So now all of a sudden, a month out, you have the governor shifting his message. He still won't agree to actually have a one-on-one debate with his Democratic challenger, Mark Schauer, former congressman. And so it's a very interesting dynamic where partly because they didn't respond to those allegations over education, they're now in much more dire straits than they were 3 months ago.
From Sanford, Florida, Roger is calling on the Independent line. Roger,
yes,
you're on the
good
air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. We've got another flip-flopper down here in Florida.
We're hitting all the big governor states.
Yeah, Charlie Crist is a flip-flopper, and he's supported Obamacare, and we are definitely, as independents, going to be supporting Rick Scott for re-election.
Well, it's going to come down to what the independents decide to do, and thank you for bringing Florida into the conversation, Roger, because I haven't mentioned it yet, and it's probably the most important and truly toss-up governor's race of the year. Rick Scott, elected in 2010, former healthcare CEO, basically, you know, was able to spend his way to win that seat. He's never been particularly popular, but Barack Obama is really unpopular in Florida, even though he carried it twice. It's a much more kind of conservative electorate than it was in 2012 or 2008. And he's now running against Charlie Crist, you know, who was Rick Scott's Republican predecessor as governor, became an independent to run for Senate, lost to Marco Rubio in 2010. And then shortly after the 2012 campaign, after being a surrogate for Obama, he became a Democrat. And a lot of the ads on TV in Florida right now highlight his flip-flops. You know, him saying, I think Obama is terrible, we need to repeal it, then saying it's great, on a host of different issues, saying he was pro-life, then saying he was pro-choice. And so that race is really a race to the bottom because neither guy is particularly popular. A Republican spent, I think, close to $30 million on attack ads, and they really did take a toll on Charlie Crist's image. So people used to kind of like him. They thought he was a nice guy, and that's changed. People do now see him as a flip-flopper. So Rick Scott has opened a slight lead in that race, but ultimately, you know, he's still in the low or mid-40s, and he has to get to 48%. You know, you have to find a way to improve your vote share. So now I think Crist has been defined, and the race is on, can Rick Scott, the governor, convince enough people who may not like him that he is the lesser of two evils when it comes to Charlie Crist? He's trying to do that. There's an ad right now that's running in Florida, and it features his wife, and he taking a long walk on the beach holding hands, and she narrates about how they've lived the American dream, and it's supposed to be this very sweet ad that's supposed to make you like Rick Scott. All of Charlie Crist's ads aren't to make you like Charlie Crist. They're really just hammering Rick Scott on his tenure as a healthcare CEO and on his tenure as governor.
Another state that is in your survey that we haven't mentioned yet is Connecticut. Mm-hmm. On Thursday night, the candidates in the Connecticut governor's race, Democratic Governor Dan Malloy and his Republican challenger Tom Foley, they faced off in a debate. They got into a very heated exchange about Foley's decades-old arrest, in which Foley resurrected a 2004-2005 corruption investigation into Malloy.
People don't always do what you do, Tom. They don't bankrupt companies. They don't lay off workers. They don't treat people the way that you've treated them in the past. You've questioned me and questioned my integrity, Tom. I would not have done that to you, nor would I raise these subjects, but for the fact that you've gone a little over the top.
Mr. Foley, your response.
Yeah, have you seen any of your attack ads? Yeah, we're a prosecutor. You're a better prosecutor, I guess, than you are a governor, sir. Listen, you repeatedly have not been truthful about things you've said about me, including tonight. I think that leadership an important aspect of leadership is being truthful. And you refer to a fine. I was never fined by the SEC. But you, sir, were investigated for corruption in Stanford. You were investigated for corruption. I'm not sure what all these things you're talking about, which most of which aren't true, but even if they were true, happened 25, 30 years ago, have to do with Connecticut's future. And yet you're tying people up on television talking about these things at night when I'm sure they'd much rather hear about your plan for getting this state back on track and getting the economy going so we can create jobs and get people's lives moving forward.
If you believe in telling the truth, Tom, why don't you tell us how you lost $2.8 million in 2 years and why you didn't pay any income taxes in 11 or 12? Why don't you disclose that information to the public so that they can put in context what you say is a great business career? And
that was the debate on Thursday night between the candidates in Connecticut's governor's race, Democratic Governor Dan Malloy and his Republican challenger, Tom Foley. Are all of the races that you're talking about in your story quite this exciting?
Thank you for playing that clip. Steve Scully, you know, who's normally very mild-mannered, was on Twitter as that debate was going on saying, this is the most intense debate we've had on C-SPAN yet. You know, he was sort of live-tweeting some of those exchanges, and I'm glad you played that clip because that captures just the mudslinging there. And it's more than we even, you know, covered in that window. That debate was particularly nasty. A lot of these debates are nasty, and you know, it's because it's an off year, it's a non-presidential year. A lot of the commercials are aimed as much at getting people who might vote for your opponent not to show up at all as to vote for you. It's less persuading people to vote for you, but persuading people that the other guy is terrible. And you saw that in that debate. And it is a lot of negativity because you have these governors in these governor's races who were not particularly popular. And you have to, you know, their approval rating might be in the low 40s. And so you can win re-election, but it's only by being a little bit more attractive than your Democratic opponent. So we've seen that in Wisconsin, where Scott Walker's actually outperforming his approval rating. And this week, both Walker and the Republican Governors Association are running ads attacking the Democratic challenger, Mary Burke, for plagiarizing part of her jobs plan. You know, and so that's kind of a good, effective hit, and they're just going to keep hammering her on. In Kansas, Sam Brownback, again, not particularly popular. Paul Davis, a state legislator who is currently in the lead in a lot of polls, found police reports that he had been at a strip club in 1998 during a meth bust. He was never charged with any wrongdoing, but it looks very, very bad. And he was in the back room of this strip club. And now Republicans are running commercials in Kansas pointing that out, saying what happened. You can judge a person by their past and on and on and on. So to your question about the negativity, I mean, when you're seeing those kinds of ads come up in these races, you're definitely, you know, seeing this race to the bottom.
The mudslinging is happening fast and furious. We'll turn now back to our phone lines where Ann from Yorba Linda, California is on the Democratic line.
I'm not Ann. I'm Kim.
I'm sorry. You're Kim.
Hi, Kim.
There's a flip-flop going on here in California, too, and I'm one of them. I have voted Republican quite a while, and I'm going Democrat straight ticket. Part of that has to do with there's just no competition. We're here in a drought, and all I'm hearing from the Republicans is that, you know, there's nothing to see here. Keep it moving. And they're not dealing with issues. Everything is no. I look at what they're doing with the president and in Congress, and just the scales have finally dropped off my eyes.
All right, that's Ann from Yorba Linda, California. Next up is Lorraine from Bayonne, New Jersey, on the independent line.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am an independent. I don't think Christie is running on this in New Jersey. But I have to tell you, I would never vote for a Democrat at all. And even some of the Republicans I have big questions on. I mean, as far as flip-flopping, Jesus, they all flip-flop, for heaven's sakes. And there's so much money that they make from the lobbyists and every one of them. And people are struggling with their balancing their checkbooks. And the money that is being spent is awful when you look at it.
So, Lorraine, which party are you going to vote for in November?
Well, probably Republican. I mean, because what is the choice? Now, I think Cory Booker is up for senator.
Yes.
at this this election. I would never vote for him, and but he has a big chance to win, and it's mostly a Democratic state, and we don't really have a choice, even with Republicans.
Well, thanks. Yeah, first on California, Jerry Brown is not on my list. You know, he's going to win that reelection majorly, win another term. It's not competitive, despite any Republican hopes. That state is just solidly blue. In New Jersey, it's interesting. There's not a governor's race. Chris Christie obviously kind of ran up his margin a year ago with reelection, with kind of a presidential campaign in mind. Has been on defense over Bridgegate now for the last year, trying to put that behind him. In the Senate race, it's actually interesting. Cory Booker won a special election last year. In October of 2013, he's up. He's going to almost certainly win re-election. He's facing a guy named Jeff Bell, who was a Ronald Reagan speechwriter in the 70s, ran for Senate in 1978 and defeated an incumbent Republican senator in the primary in 1978, then lost to Bill Bradley in the general election that year. He came down, moved to Virginia, has worked at think tanks for decades, and he decided as kind of a late-life crisis, I guess, to move back to New Jersey and to try running against Cory Booker. And it's been a funny campaign. He's close friends with Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard. And so he's gotten a lot of kind of love from the right and the right-leaning blogs and magazines, et cetera. But Cory Booker will win that race in New Jersey. It's kind of fun to watch, though.
Next up is Aiden from Struthers, Ohio, on the Republican line.
Hey, guys. I'm calling about John Kasich and... Mm-hmm. Do you think he really is going to take the state? And the other guy, he doesn't have a license, and he's not, you know, but he's riding, you know, Obama's coattail, and maybe because it is a Democratic-leaning state that they have a shot. And just kind of wanted to get your opinion on Kasich. And,
yeah.
I mean, he's like the Chris Christie of the Midwest. And
yeah, thanks, Aiden, for your call. That is a race that people thought was going to be very competitive. On the early lists of competitive races, it was high. Ed Fitzgerald, the Democrat there, the Cuyahoga County executive, that's Cleveland, has just been a disaster. His campaign has imploded. He was seen in the back, or arguably there was some questions surrounding it, but he was in a car with a woman who wasn't his wife in a parking lot, and a police report that came out, and it was very, very sketchy. Then, you know, he didn't have an active driver's license. But it's much bigger than that. He's just run an awful campaign. And the fundraising numbers actually came out yesterday in Ohio. John Kasich raised like $1.6 million last month, and Fitzgerald raised $54,000. So this race is over. But to your broader point about John Kasich, I think he is going to run for president. And so he's going to run up the margin this year. He doesn't like to talk about it because he's focused on getting reelected. But he ran for president in 2000, dropped out when George W. Bush became the nominee. But he has the right kind of profile. He has a record he can point to in Ohio. Ohio is obviously a presidential swing state. He was in Congress. He was the chairman of the House Budget Committee during the Republican Revolution in the 90s. So I actually think he is not on a lot of those 2016 presidential candidate lists, and he's not in Washington, so we don't talk about him as much as a Marco Rubio or a Rand Paul. But John Kasich is someone to definitely keep an eye on.
Well, that's a good point that you bring up, which is, what does the outcome of these gubernatorial elections sort of say about you know, which party will sort of have momentum going into 2016?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, the governor's races are more important than the Senate races for deciding the 2016 dynamic. And really, because there's going to be gridlock in Congress, no matter what, the Republicans are going to control the House. So Obama's not going to be able to advance some ambitious agenda in his final 2 years. But if Democrats controlled some of these state legislatures or some of the state houses where they already have control of the state legislature, they could expand Medicaid in states where they haven't. They could actually implement a lot of key priorities for Barack Obama. And that's one of the reasons he is willing to help. But there's actually a lot of frustration among Democrats that Obama isn't doing more to help the governors, help the Democratic Governors Association, et cetera. On some of these races, there are very important 2016 implications. Scott Walker, who I mentioned in Wisconsin, very tough race. He won the recall election in 2012. Walker is going to run for president if he wins the election this November. If he loses, his political career is essentially done. But I think he's going to end up winning by 1 or 2 points. But so it has implications there. I think Rick Snyder might try to run for president. if he wins re-election in Michigan. And so there are a lot of people, and it's kind of funny to watch because Chris Christie from New Jersey is actually the chairman of the Republican Governors Association. So he's out raising a lot of money and he's traveling. And this past week, he was campaigning with both Scott Walker in Wisconsin and John Kasich in Ohio, which is funny because both of them are probably going to be his competition just next year for the presidential nomination.
Friends or enemies, right?
Right, with some very awkward photos.
Right. Next up is Adriana from St. Petersburg, Florida, on the Democratic line.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling about the flip-floppers. We have Chris and Scott. What do you prefer, a flip-flopper or a corrupted governor? Well, I don't like either of the two, but I rather go with the flip-flopper. That was governor for a while, was good to the people, and he has a good family record, better than Scott. Scott now is a family man when he's only a material businessman. And we had the opportunity that Obama, the funds for the rail from Orlando to Tampa, which would have given us jobs, he said no. But when they said that they should background check people on food stamps, he said yes. When we all know that his wife's business has been a drug testing lab or medical lab for years. So what do I prefer? I prefer a flip-flopper that is honest, not a corrupted one with a lot of money. Thank you.
Adriana has just captured an important dynamic in Florida, which is, why are so many Democrats supporting this guy who was a Republican governor only 4 years ago? And a lot of it is because they hate Rick Scott. a lot of it is they also want to win. And so, you know, kind of one of the amazing stories of this year was that Charlie Crist, this guy who was a rock-ribbed conservative a decade ago, was able to essentially coast to the Democratic nomination. He had a primary opponent, but not a credible one. And he had the support and backing of everyone here. But what was interesting and what's now becoming an issue in this final month in the Florida governor's race is that unlike other Democrats in marginal states where the president's approval rating has taken a hit, those governors have tried to distance themselves from Obama. They've distanced themselves on the health care law. They've distanced themselves on a lot of the unpopular stuff. Charlie Crist has actually gotten closer to Obama. He's someone who I think wants Obama to campaign with him, even though it probably actually wouldn't be that helpful for him politically, but that's their mentality. And because he was trying to shore up the Democratic base, when voters like Adriana, he has kind of praised Obamacare repeatedly, said it's great, and that helped him shore up the Democratic base. But now that actually might make the difference with the independent caller that we heard from earlier, which is, you know, do you want an Obama Democrat, or do you want, you know, who is a flip-flopper, or do you want Rick Scott, kind of the person you know?
From Muncie, Indiana now, Dean is on the Democratic line. Dean, go ahead.
Yes. I was thinking if we didn't have a Democrat, Independent, or Republican parties, these people just ran on their name and not on any Democrat ticket or Republican ticket. We just ran on their ideas. I think that people would vote for the person. And also, I think that every American should listen and watch the documentary on Michael Moore's documentary on Sicko. And after all these politicians leave, they're all going to be working for, for the stock market people. And that's all I have to say.
Thanks, Dean. Yeah, the no labels thing, labels are helpful. and you kind of have to put on a jersey in a lot of ways in these states. And it's an organizing principle or a system with two parties.
We have a couple of comments from Twitter as well. One from Rick Lundstrom, who asked, James, do you see the Minnesota governor's race as competitive at all? And also Robin Eller says, I think the phrase race to the bottom pretty much describes politics in America.
Thanks, Robin. I think that's right in a lot of these places. You don't see many inspiring, uplifting kind of messages these days, especially in the final month. Rick, Minnesota's my home state. It's where I grew up. And I don't see the governor's race as competitive. I spent time around both candidates. Jeff Johnson is the Republican nominee. The Star Tribune poll showed that he's down double digits. Mark Dayton is not necessarily super popular, but he's going to end up winning that race. And the business community really hasn't stepped up on the Republican side to help Republicans win the Minnesota State House, which was a priority for much of this year. And so it looks like Dayton will win re-election. Al Franken, the senator, is up for re-election. He's also favored at this point, although Republicans nominated a fairly impressive kind of businessman in Mike McFadden, but he hasn't been able to make that a race. It's still double digits in the polls. And you know, there's a couple interesting House races in Minnesota, actually. Stuart Mills, who Minnesotans will know as being the scion of the Mills Fleet Farm fortune, is in a very competitive race with Rick Nolan, a Democrat in the upper part of the state by Lake Superior. So that's kind of fun to watch. But no, I don't expect any change at the governor's race or the Senate level.
One another state that we haven't really gotten into detail yet is Kansas, which you've mm-hmm. mentioned a couple of times. Senator Jerry Moran actually will join our Newsmakers program on Sunday. And here he is talking about Kansas politics and Governor Brownback's race and why governor's races are different from senator's races in Kansas. Here's a preview.
It's not that Kansans are frustrated with Republicans. It's that Kansans are frustrated with Washington, D.C., incumbents, nothing happening, a belief that the country's headed in the wrong direction, and nothing seems to be being done about it.
But how does that explain Governor Brownback? I mean, you have a Republican governor who actually has been very proactive and saw his legislative agenda enacted by the state legislature.
You know, when it comes to gubernatorial campaigns and elections, Kansas is much more divided. When I say we haven't elected a Democrat to the United States Senate, that is true. We haven't done that since 1932. We've had a number of Democrat governors over the years. And in fact, it's a pretty rare thing that Republican governors get reelected. So that's an unusual thing. I just think that when it comes to the governor's race, this is typical Kansas having this debate about the role of state government, the tax code, education funding. Ultimately, I think Governor Brownback wins this race. Again, Kansas is not going to be a Democrat state with the November election. But I think the dynamics of a governor's race is significantly different than the dynamics of a Senate race.
James Holman, your comments on the clip.
I'm covering both races very closely, and they are different. The key for Republicans to win in the Senate race is to connect the independent candidate there, Greg Orman, to Barack Obama. Sam Brownback can't really connect his Democratic challenger to Obama. It's just these are state issues that this is being decided on, not federal issues. So I think Senator Moran is right about that. But at the end of the day, Republicans could very well lose both the governor's race and the Senate race.
We have time for one last caller, and that will be Cy from Akron, Ohio, on the Democratic line. Cy, you have the last word for the segment.
Thank you. There are only 9 executing states left. One is Ohio, and therefore we want to get rid of Governor Kasich, who also has cut library funding 5 times while he has given increased money to teach children to kill animals with bows and arrows. He has sent virtually $500 million back to Washington and quashed our mass transit program, while at the same time his health department is promoting Gardasil for cervical vaccines, which is a drug which has destroyed the ovaries of countless women and killed dozens.
Interesting you mentioned capital punishment there. It obviously we're having kind of a renewed conversation about it. There have been some botched executions. But capital punishment is not really surfacing in these governor's races, and it's kind of remarkable you bring that up, and it really isn't coming up in ads. It's not coming up on the trail. I think, you know, in a lot of these states, the reason why is that capital punishment is still popular, and no Democrat wants to run against it. But thank you for your question.
James Holman, political reporter for Politico, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Next, our campaign 2014 coverage continues with a live debate in the Montana at-large House district race. Then a conversation with Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates on the Ebola epidemic and other global health issues. After that, more on the Ebola outbreak with a look at the U.S. response at home and abroad.
Now our coverage of campaign 2014 continues with a live debate in the U.S. House at Large District race in Montana. The candidates are Democrat John Lewis and Republican Ryan Zinke. The debate in Bozeman is courtesy of KTVQ-TV and the Montana Television Network stations.
The Montana Television Network, in partnership with Montana PBS. This is Campaign 2014, the House Debate. Made possible thanks to support from the Greater Montana Foundation. The Greater Montana Foundation, founded by Montana broadcasting pioneer Ed Craney, supports communications on issues, trends, and values of importance to all Montanans.
Debate night here on the Montana Television Network. We thank you for tuning in tonight. I'm Jay Cohn. I'll be moderating tonight's debate. We look at the U.S. House race here in Montana between Republican Ryan Zinke and Democrat John Lewis. This is a big week for this campaign. These two candidates met in a radio debate earlier this week in Billings, but tonight is the only televised face-to-face debate between the two candidates, at least that we know of at this speaking. We'd like to welcome our audience tonight statewide on the Montana Television Network stations. We're also coming to you statewide on Montana PBS stations across the state of Montana. And we're also going nationwide tonight on C-SPAN. So wherever our viewers are tuning in, we welcome you to Montana's U.S. House debate. Just a few ground rules to go over. We'll have no opening statements tonight. The candidates will be asking, answering questions from our panelists. We'll be giving 60 seconds for those answers, and each candidate will then have a 30-second rebuttal. They'll have 2 minutes for a closing statement. They will be taking a one-minute break midway through. Some quick ground rules for our audience. We're here from the Riverside Country Club in Bozeman with a small group of campaign friends, family on both sides of the aisle here. We ask everyone to hold their applause to the very end. We're all adults, and we're not going to answer our cell phones during this debate as well. Let's do our first introduction, first of all, for Republican nominee Ryan Zinke. Ryan, nice to see you here. Ryan is a third-generation Montanan. He is a standout athlete at Whitefish High School. He was a standout in several sports. He went to the University of Oregon on an athletic scholarship, earning a degree in geology, a Bachelor of Science degree. He's had a 23-year career with the military in the U.S. Navy, two stints with the Navy SEALs. In 2008, he was elected to the Montana State Senate, where he chaired the Senate Education Committee, and just a couple of years ago, he ran for lieutenant governor. He is also the CEO of a consulting firm that specializes in advanced technology for aerospace and oil and gas. He and his wife, Lolita, have three children. Ryan, welcome tonight.
Great to be here.
Now we welcome Democratic nominee John Lewis. John is a fourth-generation Montana, and he and his wife, Melissa, have two children, Kate and Jackson. John Lewis was born in Billings, a Magic City boy, but he was raised in both Billings and Missoula. Most recently, he served as state director for Senator Max Baucus, a position he held for 4 years, supervising a staff of 20. He's a graduate of Western Washington University with a degree in political science and communications. And he touts his top legislative accomplishments as tackling veterans' unemployment issues and also helping many Montana communities wade through the bureaucratic red tape for flood disaster following the 2011 floods in Montana. John Lewis, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, Jay.
And it's my pleasure to introduce you now to our panel who will be asking our candidate questions. First, we welcome Donna Kelly right in the middle of our, on this end of our panel questioning. Donna is from KBZK Television. She's been with the Bozeman station now for 8 years. Donna also worked prior to that for many years with CNN in Atlanta. And she wanted me to tell you that she also had several overtures to work for Fox as well during those years. I can tell you that Donna and I started our television careers together, let's just say many decades ago, at a small television station in Helena, Montana. Donna, good to see you tonight. Jill Valley is sitting in the middle of our panel tonight. Jill is from KPAX-TV. She's been anchoring the news there for 22 years. She is a six-time Montana Broadcaster of the Year. Jill, good to see you tonight. Last, certainly not least, is my co-anchor at KTVQ Television in Billings. Please welcome Janelle Slade. She is a two-time Montana Broadcaster of the Year. She went straight from college to Q2, spent a few years on the dark side in communications and public relations, but we welcomed her back to Q2 a couple of years ago. So that is our panel tonight. But I get the first question, and let's get going because we just have 1 hour to get through this. I'm sorry that took as long as it did. John Lewis, we flipped coins, and you get the first question tonight, at least answering it. And it comes from me.
As we speak, Congress has an 8% approval rating. The calling card of Congress is partisan gridlock. This is a do-nothing Congress on steroids this past Congress. So my question is, why in the world do you want to join this esteemed group? And what can you do, what do you bring to the table to change this culture in Washington that has our country stuck on hold?
Sure. Thank you very much, Jay. I want to thank Montana News Stations for hosting this debate and welcome Donna and Jill and Janelle for being panelists. When I first got in this race, I gave a speech, one of the earliest events I did, and I talked about my past experiences and things I learned while working on legislation for trying to help veterans and other experience I had fighting for Montanans. Someone came up to me after the speech and said, I respect your past experiences, but I'm more interested in the future and the ideas you have to get Congress working for Montana and how you're going to be part of the solution. That was great advice. We've run a campaign on Montana ideas. We've released plans for agriculture, for energy, for public lands, and that's what I want to see Congress do, is work on solutions to move Montana forward. It's true. Congress has about a 9% approval rating. I read somewhere that cockroaches and root canals have a higher standing than 9%. Root canals. We can do better than that. I'm a concerned father. I've got two young kids. I'm concerned about their future. And I want to see Congress work together again on solutions. That's why I'm running.
Ryan, you sure after this you still want this job?
Well, the 21st century can and will be an American century, but we're going to have to earn it. You know, I wear a Navy SEAL trident in my chest. There's a saying in the SEALs that you have to earn your trident every day. And in our country, we have to relearn how to earn our liberty and have an economy that we can have jobs and obtain the American dream. And it is about the American dream and families. And in Montana, we struggle. Our nation struggles. No one trusts the government. No one trusts Congress. No one trusts the administration. We have to restore trust. We have to make sure our economy is prosperous. And today's debate, I think, will highlight some different contrasts between the candidates, and I think the choice will be clear.
Mr. Lewis, any rebuttal for either one?
Well, I've, like I said, focused this campaign on the future and ideas on the future. And so far in the campaign, I've heard very little about ideas for the future from my opponent. I've heard about what he was doing in 1988. This race is not about what we were doing in 1988. I've heard that he loves America, and we all love America and Montana. And I look forward to hearing his ideas about how we're going to strengthen public lands in this country. And if you want to see Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, repealed, well, then what's your plan for ensuring the millions of Americans that don't have insurance in this country, including 179,000 Montanans? What's the plan? That's what I look forward to hearing tonight.
Ryan.
Well, let's talk about the debt. Your plan about selling used cars and abandoned buildings and cutting congressional pay is a joke. It's not even a rounding error. If we want to get serious about America and restoring America, we're going to have to address the debt. And yes, I do support the Ryan plan as a framework because I think balancing the budget in 10 years is obtainable. There's a lot I don't agree with it. I think we can do it without challenging and eliminating and cutting Medicare. I think we can do it without cutting Social Security. I think we can do it without cutting education. But I do think that we have to address the challenges and not put our head in the sand. It's been too long since we put our head in the sand. And I do think we can work together, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, to carve out a better future because everyone knows we're in trouble. So are we going to ignore the problems or are we going to actually address them? And tonight we'll talk about addressing the issues.
Speaking of issues, let's get right to it. Donna Kelly, you have the first question.
Now for you, Mr. Zinke, since Mr. Lewis asked the first question. So with your military background, and then over the last couple of days,
there's been a firestorm over Leon Panetta's book. Just came out about a day and a half ago or so, and everybody's talking about a Democratic congressman who was a former CIA director in the Obama administration, a former Secretary of Defense, and he is laying this squarely at the feet of the administration, the Obama administration, for not getting in those negotiations with Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki so that we had to leave. So I'll get to that question with you, Mr. Lewis, but let's talk with your military background. How long could we stay if al-Maliki was not willing to let us stay there? Can you just camp out and stay? And who's going to pay for it?
Well, yeah, good question on that. I think you know, I was reluctant to enter Iraq because my daughter's a Navy diver, my son-in-law is a Navy SEAL. Hey, there's no one more reluctant to go to war than me. But if you go to war, you make sure you go to war to win. You get the rules of engagement so our troops in harm's way can and will win. In the case of Iraq leaving, we not only left early, we left without a SOFA agreement, which is a status of forces agreement. And that should not be overlooked. That one agreement allows our soldiers, they get prosecuted if they are allegedly conducted something wrong under our judicial system. Without a status of forces agreement, one of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and marine could actually get prosecuted under Islamic law. Or if a pilot errors and has collateral damage, he could be prosecuted perhaps for murder rather than under our UCMJ. And also control and status and stability. You look what's happening with ISIS today. We're going to fight ISIS. And I'd rather fight ISIS in the deserts of Iraq than the streets of America. And it's already here. Ask the gal from Great Falls who had her head severed, if you could ask her, because that's ISIS.
But did we have to go? If al-Maliki said you're not staying, and they didn't get through the negotiations.
There was multiple opportunities to stay. There was multiple opportunities for administration to get involved, and they chose not to. There was multiple opportunities to check ISIS at the beginning, and we chose not to. This is what happens when you lead from the rear and not from the front, because if the United States does not lead, no one else will.
Would you have supported the administration when they said, we're going to have to pull out, we don't have anything on paper that we can stay, and then it's progressed to this point where now are we playing catch-up in the game, fighting ISIS with airstrikes and trying to get back territory that we already spent a lot of blood and treasure on?
Look, the safety of Americans is our number one priority, and ISIS does not share our values, and they obviously have no regard for human life. But we need to learn from the mistakes of the last 12 years of nation building in Iraq. And when I hear I'd rather fight that war in the deserts of Iraq than here at home, I think that's a simplistic way of looking at the problem. They estimate there are 1 billion Muslims in this world. They're not all in that region. 1 billion Muslims. Out of that 1 billion, they say about 15% are Islamic extremists. If it's 15%, that's 150 million Islamic extremists. The idea that we can just bomb our way out of this problem is not realistic to me.
For both of you, airstrikes now to try and gain back some of the ground that ISIS has taken, but will there have to be boots on the ground?
Look, I support doing whatever we need to do to keep our Americans safe, and security is our number one priority. That's what I said first. But we need to be thoughtful about our approach. And number one, Congress needs to debate this issue and authorize force, fulfill their constitutional responsibility. And how much is it going to cost? What's the budget? What's the end game? And I just don't think the correct response is to instantly say we need to put troops on the ground in Iraq.
My opponent called for economic sanctions against ISIS. Now tell me how you put economic sanctions against a non-nation state. Maybe we should perhaps write a tersely worded letter. The issue is that ISIS is a danger. It's a danger to here. I think you have to have a three-pronged approach. You have to shut down our southern border. Our southern border is no longer an immigration issue. It's a security and immigration threat. A nation that can build a Panama Canal in the 19th century certainly can build a fence in the 21st. Secondly, unfortunately, it's going to call for America to lead. And you cannot control ISIS by air alone. In the words of General Conway, 4-star, former commandant of the Marine Corps, there isn't a snowball's chance in hell that air operations will work, and I agree. Secondly, limit our ground forces to special forces, to supply and support. We make sure our coalitions that we choose are watched and efficiently trained. and limit our involvement, but make sure that ISIS is destroyed.
Quick follow-up, because no one answered how we're paying for this. We've already put two wars on the credit card. Would you be willing to support a war tax to support, as Donna said, a perpetual war that we seem to be in?
Look, there's two clearly different approaches to this situation here on this issue. And I'm saying we need to be thoughtful and responsible in decisions. No, a letter is not going to get the job done. But this is somebody who called for invading Mexico a few weeks ago because we have an American in jail in Tijuana. That's not the kind of judgment I want representing me in Congress. And his instant reaction to the president's announcement that we would have airstrikes was, let's send in more troops. He also said a couple years ago that when the president announced that women should serve in combat roles in this country, he said that is nearly certain to cost lives, nearly certain to cost lives, women serving in combat roles. That's not the judgment we need in Congress. And it's a good question, Jay. How much is this going to cost? And it needs to be debated in Congress and authorized.
Quick rebuttal, Ryan. How do we pay for this?
We pay for it by having a strong economy. A Navy costs money. Bridges, schools, infrastructure. That all costs money, paying for Medicare, Social Security. We need a robust economy. And John, I know you didn't serve, but Tiramisu is a Marine that has been languishing in a prison in Mexico for over 6 months. Every man, woman, and I've served both, and I've commanded both. Everybody that serves in this country makes sure that America has their back. And when America doesn't have their back, like Benghazi, like Mexico, what happens is it sends a signal to every veteran fighting, you know what, America's not going to be there. I did not advocate invading Mexico. I advocated the president doing his duty and doing by all available means to get the young Marine back.
Next question goes to Jill Valley.
All right, I'm going to start with Mr. Lewis. Talking about money a little bit, you've criticized Mr. Zinke for taking 70% of his money from out of state, outside of Montana, because it makes him captive to out-of-state interests. Well, John Tester got 80% of his money in that same vein, so is he, too, also captive to out-of-state interests?
The reason I've highlighted that I've taken over 70% of the money that I've raised in this race is from Montana is because it's unusual, and I'm proud of that, very proud. I've worked very hard to raise and finance this campaign from Montana. And there's a huge difference between the way I've done it and the way my opponent has done it. He has raised most of his money from California, Texas, and Florida, three states. And those three states combined have 116 representatives in Congress. We have one representative. Look, I said from the beginning, we're going to run a Montana campaign on Montana ideas and financed by Montanans. And I've worked very hard at that, including contribution from all 56 counties. So I'm very proud of that record. And comparing it to the 2012 election is comparing apples and oranges. In that election, $50 million was spent in Montana in the Senate race alone. That's disgusting to most Montanans. And so we're going to keep doing what we're doing, focusing on Montana ideas, and focusing on running a Montana race financed by Montanans.
Well, I'm not going to apologize for having a national stage. I'm not going to apologize for going to different states and having coalitions between different congressmen. But the facts are this. I have 18,000 donors. Most of them are small donors. That 18,000 donors compared to about three represents veterans and seniors that share a common idea, that America is exceptional. Do I like the fact that you have to reach out of the state? No. Max Bach has had about 90%. No one criticizes that. But the fact of the matter is, having a national platform means you can do national things. It means you can reach into coalitions and meet other congressmen. Because we only have one congressman in the state of Montana. One out of 435, not a lot of vote. You're going to need to gain coalitions, friendships, relationships based on American exceptionalism.
Our next question goes to Janelle.
And this is for Mr. Zinke. I'd like to address where most of our Montana voters see the two of you, and that's on television, in political ads. Mr. Zinke, in one of your ads, you repeatedly reference your milestones in life versus John Lewis's age. All of your milestones getting through your life as he's growing up. Can you help us with the message that you are trying to get across in this ad?
Yeah, more leadership, less politics. I've spent my life leading. I have an MBA, an MS in finance. I've done education. Being a naval officer is more than just leading troops into combat. It's also looking at challenging, complex problems and finding solutions that are real. I've sat down with warlords and agreed back and forth on solutions. I can certainly sit down between Democrats and Republicans, as I did in the Senate, to find real solutions.
You continually bring up his age. Do you feel that because you are older, you make a better leader? So the older someone is, the better leader they are?
No, I bring up a comparison of two lives, and it's a positive campaign. I've had a lot of experience. I've done a lot of things in my life. I've been more than a Washington staffer. I've been more than in politics. I've been a business guy. I understand the private side. I've been an educator. I understand education curriculum. I know how to lead. And most of all, I know how to solve problems, because the problems facing our country are large and daunting. But they are fixable. I mean, we created them, and we can fix them.
John Lewis, rebuttal.
Look, age is arbitrary. What you stand for and why you're running for this position is not. If he were running against Teddy Roosevelt, he'd tell him he was too young. If he was running against Ronald Reagan, he'd tell him he was too old. Look, I can't do anything about the fact that I was born in 1978. But my experience is very relevant to what we're trying to do here. I've worked on legislation in D.C., helping veterans. I've worked on issues right here in Montana. I've been to all 56 counties, helping seniors get a Social Security check. So that experience is very relevant. Age, look, I go back to what I said in the very beginning here. This election is about the future. What ideas you have for the future, not what you were doing in the 80s and 90s.
Follow up on that. Like we're talking about the congressional ads, let's talk about your ad, Ryan Zinke. Can we just agree right now that John Lewis did not write the Affordable Care Act?
Well, he didn't write it all, but being the state director, it was his job to make sure the values and the interests were reflected in that bill. And when Montana businesses called, what were they told? They were told, you know what, don't grow your business past 50. Make sure you don't employ your employees more than 30 hours. That hurts business. That hurts every family. And as a state director, that's your responsibility.
But your ad says that he wrote it. That's not what you just described, isn't it?
On a typewriter.
On a typewriter. So that's not true.
I don't think he wrote it all.
John, you have an ad campaign that says you want to cut congressional pay. Can we just agree right now no one's going to cut congressional pay, because it's going to take an act of Congress to cut congressional pay?
Yeah.
And really, what would that accomplish?
Well, first of all, let me say something very quickly about those health care ads. And look, we have millions of uninsured Americans in this country. And what is the solution to insure those Americans? There are tens of thousands of Montanans additionally that are benefiting. There's somebody in the audience tonight. He's named Al Kesselheim. He's a part-time teacher, lost his insurance January, and he signed up on the exchange for insurance today. And he's paying half of what he paid before. There's thousands of Montanans like that. So if you want to repeal Obamacare, if you want to repeal the legislation, what are you going to tell Al and his family and his kids what he's going to do? Because he would lose that insurance.
Well, we're not cutting congressional pay. That was the question.
Look, Congress has a 9% approval rating. They need to do their part. Will it solve our deficit issues? No. But I also said that if you can't pass a budget, you shouldn't get paid. Congress hasn't passed a budget in over 1,000 days. And so, look, this is about Congress doing their part.
Ryan, quick rebuttal.
Well, there's 20,000 Montanans that lost their insurance. 20,000. Yeah, there are. And let me further say this. Is it, do we need affordable health care? Absolutely. Can we do it better? Absolutely. But one size fits all from Washington isn't the solution. I understand there's some good things about Obamacare, pre-existing conditions, that's good. But we're going to see more and more people lose their insurance. What makes you think that if you couldn't afford insurance before, that all of a sudden you magically get a subsidy and you have a $9,000 deductible? What makes you think you can pay that $9,000 deductible if you can't afford insurance in the beginning? You can't. So there are a lot of ways to make sure we have affordable health care. Pooling, tort reform, look at individual health care accounts, low-cost clinics. There are a number of things that make a difference to Montana, which is an aging population.
Okay, we're going to get into Obamacare, I'm sure, later. Next question. I think we have time for one more question before we go to break. Donna, your turn.
Okay. As long as we brought up age, some of us are rapidly approaching Social Security, and others, certainly, we've done it for decades and decades and talked about it as the Holy Grail, don't touch it. But for those of us who are getting close, and yes, that's me raising my hand, the ball keeps moving down the field. You know, it's 62, then it's 65, then it's 70, and a percentage that you're going to get. Would you change it? Can we keep it? How would you make it better? And are you going to keep moving the ball? And I've lost track of who gets that first. I'm sorry.
Mr. Zinke.
Well, I think we can keep our promises. It's Social Security. And I sat down with Mercator's Institute and looked at the numbers. And Social Security is absolutely healthy for those that earned it. If you worked all your life and that was a promise made, that portion of Social Security can be healthy. But what's happened is you have a lot of new people, holes in the ship, that are draining that fund out. And Congress has stole from it multiple times. And again, it goes back to how are we going to afford all these things? We need a robust economy. And how do you get a robust economy? You have to look at making sure government goes back in its roles so America can innovate and think out of the box again. The regulatory environment, not through Congress, but just the regulatory burden on business in 1 year, 2012, was $3.6 trillion. 1 year. When you look at that amount of overburden regulation, doesn't involve clean air, clean water, it's just stifling innovation. And secondly, energy independence. I'm an optimist. If we focus on those two things, then we can keep the promises. We can make sure we honor our veterans, the pledges. And there's a lot of expenses out there. But $18 trillion, I think 10 years to balance the budget is a reasonable amount of time. I think we can accelerate our economy to make sure we have a prosperous economy moving forward, and we can fix it. I'm positive we can.
This right here is a clock. When it gets to zero, that's 60 seconds, and that was about a minute 30 on your answer.
Oh, I have one left.
John, your rebuttal.
I didn't hear an answer in that response about Social Security. One in five Montanans enjoy the benefits of Medicare and Social Security. If we do nothing today, the Social Security Trust Fund will be solvent until 2033. But we do need to do something and keep it solvent for many years after that. I support an idea that's endorsed by AARP, and that's to raise the payroll tax cap. And for people that make over $117,000, they need to continue to pay into that Social Security Trust Fund so we can keep it solvent. For those that have...
For how long?
Be more specific, Donna. How long?
You said they need to keep paying if they're making over $100,000. They need to keep paying into it. For how long?
I think we should all do our part. Absolutely. Do our part with the goal of making that trust fund solvent for many years beyond 2033.
Okay, we're going to drill down real quick. On the retirement age, do you support raising the retirement age? That's a way to help pay for some of this. Is that something you would look at?
Or a percentage.
Right. No, I do not at this time. Look, people work their lives for these benefits. They need the assurance that it's going to be there for them when they retire. And let's not keep moving the goalposts for retirees. I don't support that.
Ryan?
I don't think it's necessary.
And
I don't think it's necessary, and I would not support it because, again, is that the Social Security program itself, if you just look at those who have earned it, and most of Montanans have earned it over a period of their lives, and that's the way it was designed. And it's solvent if you look at that. And I think it should go back and make Social Security exactly what it was. It's for those people that have earned it over a period of time, it will be there, and we have to make sure we keep our promises. And I'm the guy that's trying to save it. I'm trying the guy that's making sure we're financially solvent, save Medicare, save Social Security, so the check.